fast. What? Keep it fresh. Dope girls. Dope girls. Hi, welcome to Female Trouble, a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. I'm Quinn Kelly. I work here at the Baltimore Sun, and each week I'm going to be having a conversation with one of the city's many interesting and accomplished women. For our first episode, I talked to Teedra Wilson, better known as TT the Artist. She's a Baltimore-based rapper, and I really enjoyed learning more about her childhood, which was pretty unique. We talked about how she ended up in Baltimore and how she made a name for herself here, and we also talked a little bit about Beyonce, which is always fun. Thanks for listening. Here's my conversation with TT. So you are actually featured in our theme song for the podcast, Dope Girls, which is a perfect anthem for this kind of thing.
Right.
How did that collaboration with DJ Shifty come about?
Well, it was just natural. We had collaborated in the past, but you know, we never had something that hit. So he sent me this record and I loved the instrumental, and I just immediately recorded some vocals, sent it back to him, and you know, Dope Girls was born. You know, I'm always trying to put in a woman's empowering theme throughout a lot of my music, but I also wanted to showcase a positive, you know, something a little more that was universal for all ages and something that all women from different demographics could relate to. So the collaboration itself was pretty natural, you know, and now we actually have a remix project featuring our all-woman lineup of producers that just dropped on Apple Music and iTunes.
So you have a little bit of experience in radio, I hear.
Yes. Yeah, prior to really pursuing music professionally, I moved back to Baltimore from New York, and I started working with a group of friends, and they had a radio station on, they had a radio show on 1010 AM called Off the Edge Radio. And initially I came on as just a guest co-host, but I saw very quickly that they needed a little help with programming. So I jumped right in as a producer for the radio show. We started bringing in other local talent from Baltimore and running specials and interviews with that talent. And then we translated it to an online series where we actually videotaped the live interviews, and then we posted them online for, you know, it to stream. So it was very, very exciting. And from radio, I ended up moving to television. At one point, I was a host on Keeping It Real TV, which was airing on the CW network. So I was doing a lot of that, and a lot of that was putting me in a lot of different spaces and venues and nightclubs and meeting different artists. So I began to kind of cross over my music and network through these opportunities.
And you've always been a multidisciplinary artist, right?
Yeah.
So Micah is what brought you to Baltimore. What was your time like there, and what did you study? What kind of projects were you working on?
Well, Micah was definitely an experience for me. I knew that I wanted to have a background in arts, but I had no idea what my focus would be when I first got there as a freshman. So I jumped around a bit. I started off as a video major because at that time, this was new. Video and media was a new platform, and no one was really doing it on the level where they're doing it now, where technology has advanced. So it has, a lot of people have access to video now. But so I started there, and I kind of felt like I was self-teaching myself with video. So I jumped to the teaching program because I was like, well, I need to get a job when I graduate. You know, I don't want to just be this starving artist. But I felt like teaching was something that came naturally to me, and I wasn't really adapting to the structure of the program, the MAT program. So I finally settled with a general fine arts major, where I was able to build my own curriculum that involved having, I could focus on anything from photography, graphic design, illustration, video. I could make my own curriculum and still graduate on time. And that's what I ended up doing, was graduating with a bachelor's in general fine arts with a concentration in video. And I didn't know that later on, having obtained all these skills, that it would be essential in my development as an artist today.
Are you someone who always has to have a million projects going on? It sounds like you're a big multitasker.
I mean, yeah, I just like to stay busy, you know, and moving around. When I do that, I get inspired. And so if I don't jump on the project right away, I write it down. You know, I have notebooks from years ago that have notes and to-do lists of things that I wanted to do. And then I open those notebooks and I realize, oh, man, I ended up doing it. Or, oh man, I forgot. I did always want to do that. So there's always something to do. And I think anytime you're working on one project, you should already be conceiving the next one in terms of planning it out. And that's just kind of how I operate and thrive as a person. Like, it makes me feel alive when I know I have things going on.
When you are working on a mixtape or an album, does that mean you're already thinking down the road? You're already thinking about the next albums and your trajectory as an artist, or do you kind of take those one at a time?
Absolutely. When I'm working on projects, I already have about five other projects that are already in the works. Like, I'm simultaneously creating, and they get put out at moments, you know. So I have records that I've recorded a year ago that are just not getting put out today, and then I have records that I recorded yesterday that might get put out 2 months from now, because timing is everything with music, you know, especially if you're doing different genres of music. As an artist, sometimes you feel the need to put certain things out at certain points based on what's happening in our society, what's happening around you, how you feel emotionally. So I always have different ideas that I'm planning, you know, and I think it's just a matter of making it your lifestyle and getting a good workflow going, because when you can do that, then it's not like, oh, you know, I'm just rushing and putting things out, but you just kind of have things in the pot already cooking. So when the meal is ready, you can serve it. So that's kind of how I am. I like to always keep other ideas generating, even as one idea is the focus.
And how do you know when it's the right time to put something out?
Man, I think, you know, well, depending on what your schedule or calendar is like as an artist, like, and where you're trying to go with your career. Some artists, they're just doing it for the love, and they, you know, they're happy just doing local shows, or, you know, they're not really into the marketing and business aspects of it. So they may drop projects whenever they feel the need to. And then you have an artist that's, if the artist is, this is more their life, everyday thing, and they're constantly pursuing the career of it and the business side of it, you want to have a schedule where you're releasing music every year, or summer, spring, fall, winter, because what that does is it sets you up for touring. It sets up your calendar to stay active. So, you know, for me, I try to have two projects come out a year, whether it's a album or a mixtape or EP, something to keep feeding the people. Now, you can allow to do one really strong project and let it just go for a year, but it really just depends on how busy you get, you know. Like, you may do one project and then that project blows off and takes off and you're booked year round for it, you know. So for me though, how I've been operating is just trying to stay consistent, and I feel like how I know when a project is right is based on what I see going on and how I feel and what makes the best business sense.
So you have to think a lot more about the business sense, I would imagine, because you are independent, so you don't have a label manager who can get mad at you if you just go against them and drop a mixtape whenever you want.
Right.
Do you enjoy being an advocate for yourself in that way and taking on all of the business responsibilities?
I don't enjoy taking on all the business responsibilities, but one thing about being independent is that you do learn the business responsibilities. So when you get to a point where you need management or you want a label, you're understanding different terms. You're able to read contracts because you've had to either write a contract at some point in your career, or you've had to speak with a lawyer at some point in your career. So I think every artist, regardless of whether they have a deal or not, should should prepare themselves on business matters when it comes to music. And, you know, I hope that for me, as I grow, my team grows, because you can't do this on your own. I mean, as an independent artist, you still need a team. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, right now, the goal is not to stay solo. The goal is to grow your team so that you can spread more, because what happens when you're focused on all those facets of the business and the industry is you can't focus on what it is that you need to focus on, which is creating the music. So it's times where I can't write when I feel it, because I have to read over contracts, or I have to communicate with these producers, something that, you know, a label would be able to do for me, or some sort of booking agency would be able to talk with promoters who are booking my show. So, you know, I have management right now, but we're kind of, they handle administrative, and they have to wear many hats sometimes. They might have to act as a booking agent until I get a new booking agent, or I may have to act as my own booking agent. But, you know, again, it's a balancing game. And at the end of the day, though, it's good to learn it. But don't get yourself in a box, in the independent box, where you don't think you need a team. Because the more you have of a team that's real and about your mission, the more impact you'll be able to make in the long run.
as of this recording, your debut LP, Queen of the Beat, hasn't quite come out yet, but you've had the album release party, right?
Yeah. It's actually what I did, which is a lot different from what a lot of artists are doing, is because right now everyone's saying no one's buying CDs and no one's buying physical copies of things, I have made my album available at my live shows. So I started my tour. People are able to get the project at my live shows. And it's just to encourage people to come out and support the artists, and also encourage this idea that, you know, we don't always have to fall into what the status quo is and what's popular, you know. And then now I'm focusing on my online release, because of course you got to make the music available universally. So that's where I'm focusing on right now. And a lot of people are asking me about a date. And I the album is done. I'm just like listening to it over and over again, because I'm actually going to add additional tracks onto the online release. So the album that I'm putting out right now at the live shows is like a limited edition version. I only have a certain amount printed out. And then I'm actually going to do like a kind of deluxe release on iTunes and, you know, all the online streaming services. And I'm hoping like within the next week or two that it'll be live. But I'm also working on setting up a good premiere for the project. So it's a lot of things that I'm trying to put in place before I just put it out there online, because I want to maximize the amount of plays. I want to maximize the amount of people who get exposed to the project, because all the producers on this project have worked so hard on it. I would hate to just throw it out there online and the feedback isn't there, or the receptiveness is not there due to the lack of visual, you know, or the lack of the network. So like I said, when you're independent, you know, you may not have a big network that you would as with a major label. So how to do that is connect with blogs, connect with other mix show radio DJs, and try to set up a premiere for your project so that you can tap into the network of that blog, like a Pitchfork or a Vice, you know. So that's what I'm working on right now. So once that goes through, then we're gonna press the green light, and hopefully it's gonna be crazy. And I'm already working on the next one, so despite how this one does, there's gonna be more coming, like before you even blink your eye, just because I'm feeling the creative juices flowing right now.
You do have one single out from the album titled Queen, and that pays homage to women of color breaking the mold in media. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about the inspiration behind that and your own experiences that informed it?
Well, Queen is the second single off of the project, and I spent about 6 weeks trying to set up a premiere for it, and a lot of blogs were not very receptive, surprisingly, considering a lot of the stuff that I see posted on these blogs doesn't have much content at all. And, you know, I have asked the bloggers, well, what is it? They're like, oh, you know, lyrics are okay. You know, but I just feel like I don't hear much of that being discussed in terms of like where we are in the industry with women, and then with women of color specifically, which is what I identify as. So, you know, I can speak for all women, but to be more specific, the song really, when I created the song, I just wanted to give some shout outs and show some love to a few select women who are doing things or who have been doing things in media that inspire me. And despite who I shout out or how you look at those individuals, they're still thriving in their fields. And so I just wanted that song to be a powerful anthem for women and boss women, executive women, women who are, you know, claiming their rights in the corporate world, you know. So I just feel like now, more than ever, with a female running for president, with all these different advances that we're trying to get for equality and the fight for women, we need records like this to kind of generate more of that energy. And so that's what Queen was about, you know. And a lot of people will hear a song like that and say, oh, this is not the TT we know, because they're used to hearing me on a lot of dance music records. But, you know, you can't stay stuck in a box. You have to show your versatility as an artist, I think. And I started out as a hip hop rapper, and then I got into club music because it was just something I naturally adapted to. But in my road and my journey does not, it began there, it doesn't end there. You know, I'm on a mission to create world music, universal music, and tap into subjects that a lot of people can relate to.
Do you think you're often put in a box, whether it's Baltimore club, Baltimore rap, or a quote unquote, you know, good for a female rapper? I mean, do you ever hear those kinds of critiques?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I think coming in the gate, just saying you're a female rapper, you know, you're already going to get a stigma attached. Like, do you have bars? Can you flow? What's your lyrics like? Which is surprising because, you know, even with music today, like in the top 40, half of the hip hop male rappers, I mean, a lot of the lyrics are not like super overdrawn out. You have your Kendrick Lamars and then you have your Young Thugs. And you know what I mean? You have these artists who, from the male's perspective, there's a wide spectrum of range. But with the female perspective, we don't have a lot of representation. We have limited representation. And even the limited representation we have, I think is good. But I think that there are so many women out there who are doing great, great music, and the stigma that, you know, female artists can't rap or they're not as lyrical as male artists, to me, is not factual, you know? So yeah, all the time you know, people stereotype or they try to put you in a box. They want you to stick in one lane and do this and do that, but I've never been one to kind of fit into that mold. And it's a struggle with me because I know I can do that one thing and I could do it very well, but it's a lot of other things that I do very well too. So you always have to remember and keep your eyesight set on the goal and keep your eyesight set on who you are and stay true to who you are, because ultimately that is what gives you longevity in this business.
It does seem like a catch-22 for a lot of female musicians I speak to, because they want to embrace their feminism or their gender identity, but they don't want to be pigeonholed. And it's almost like you can't say, mm-hmm, I'm a proud female rapper, or I'm, you know, a proud like feminist punk band, without then being only that thing.
Exactly. I think I'm a female rapper. I mean, I'm a female. But, you know, even today, the conversation around gender is so broad. We're living in a day and age where we're talking about transgender discrimination and everybody having equal rights to, you know, feel welcome in different public spaces. So I think with some artists, they may choose to, you know, be more vocal about not putting the prefix of female before a rapper. But for me, I identify as female and I am a rapper or recording artist, so it doesn't bother me. And again, it's just like, that's what people are going to identify you as when you walk in the door and you look the way you look, you know. But again, I just think that we're living in a time right now where labeling and gender, all these things are getting shifted around. And I embrace it and I think it's great, because it shows you that a lot of people are not ready for change and evolution. Because these are just words to me. Like, when I meet someone, I see a person, and it's like, we are really living in a time where it's showing how uncomfortable people are with change. Things that don't even affect you directly, but it's just, people are trying to make a system where we all can work, like, flow better, you know, where it's not all these anti signs, you know, where it's more welcoming. But it's crazy because society really isn't ready for that evolution as a whole. I think there are people out here that need to keep fighting for those missions and for those equalities. But I just think the challenge is the mental state of society as a whole.
So do you think putting out a song like Queen that has a bold statement and is, like you said, different from stuff you've done in the past, I mean, do you consider that an artistic risk?
Absolutely. And it's even going to be more of a risk when I do the video for it. And that's kind of the background behind my genius, I think. It's like, I know what people hear. I know everything I do is strategic. Everything I do is purposeful. So when I do a song like Queen, understand there will be a visual that follows up with that. And for me, it's like, everybody's like, you know, we're at a time where we got Beyonce, one of the biggest pop stars right now, dropping conscious and political charged visuals. And Queen was like recorded a year ago. I did the first verse and the hook about a year ago, and I just did the second verse earlier this year. So it's like, had a Queen come out prior to this, you know what I mean, what would that have been like? But like I said, it's good timing because now Beyonce's the face of it. But I feel like I want to back her up and be like, yeah, it's a bunch of us out here that's been saying it, you know, so we shouldn't be going against her. In my opinion, it's very few of us that have the platform, and they're going to complain if she doesn't do it, and they're going to complain when she does. So it's like, I would never come out and speak against my own race. I don't, like, in terms of if they're trying to do something to put a light or spotlight on something that's going on socially, if it's a positive thing, like, I give them kudos. I don't care if it was done in your basement or done with the top budget, like, at least somebody's taking a moment to do it.
Did you see the SNL skit about when the world discovers that Beyonce is black?
I haven't seen that.
It's like everyone, it's white, it's right after the album drops.
Memes.
Yeah.
Saw some memes.
And it's white people enraged that maybe the album isn't for them. It's really funny. But
yeah, I think it's just entertainment too. You know, it's like, would you go to the movies and see The Butler as a white person? Yeah, because it's a part of entertainment. But would you say this movie is not for me? It's history. She's just making her statement, and she's making her mark on history. So it's like, I don't think people should feel like it's not for them. I think they should look at it as if they would look at any artist who's in the contemporary art world, or when they go to an art gallery and see fine art. I don't think they're looking at the art and saying, this art piece isn't for me. Like, you got to look at some things sometimes as a person's creative expression. That's her painting. So look at it like that. I wouldn't say block yourself from the experience just because it may not be necessarily relatable, but try to find, you know, what the artist is trying to express creatively. You know what I mean?
Let's go back to your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You're originally from Florida.
Yes.
And it sounds like you had a pretty conservative religious upbringing. Can you mm-hmm. tell me more about that?
Well, yeah, I grew up Pentecostal, which is a form of Christianity, but it was very, very strict. And, you know, I wasn't allowed to wear jeans, shorts. I had to wear skirts below my knees, sometimes all the way to my ankles. I wasn't allowed to really hang out with friends from school or anything, do anything secular. Like, it was no going to the movies. It was no, you know, it was just very boxed in. We were always in church. I mean, we was in church for like 6 to 8 hours some days. Like, why would you do that to your kids? I told my mom that all the time. But, and then the church we were going to was very, very cultish. It was just like, I can't even explain some of the things I experienced in that space or heard or saw that I questioned as I became an adult because of what I found as spirituality and what I saw growing up were two totally different things. And then when my mom finally left the church, I questioned the authenticness of it all. And I just was like, you know, why would you even stick around in something that long? But she was a child who was only allowed to go to church. So she grew up in that environment. That's all she knew. She met my dad through that church. And so naturally, as her children were born, we had to follow in that same path. But it was pretty tight. Like, I wasn't allowed to do anything. And I had to go sneak away and do things. Like, listen, everything I learned in life was me sneaking away, just being curious and nosy and wanted to explore myself. But, you know, I didn't grow up in a relationship with my mother or father where I talked about these things that I wanted to explore. So
was that a big rebellious act when you would go sneak off and listen to music? You know, if you were caught, would you have gotten in trouble?
Oh, yeah. I used to get spankings for dancing. Like, I always used to tell my mom, you know, if y'all would have let me took dance classes, because we weren't allowed to do that either. But, like, I would go to family get-togethers, and my aunts and cousins and stuff, they would amp us up, and they'll start playing music, you know. And the problem with dancing was because it was secular music. So I'd be, like, you know, dancing to the secular music and rap music, and then my mom would come pick me up, and they'll be like, oh, she was dancing? Like, they snitching, telling on me. And then I would get in trouble, and I never understood why they would do that to me as a child. So I would get a spanking for it. Like, it's been numerous occasions, and it was just all twisted. And I tell my mom to this day, I'm like, you know, if I had been able to take dance class, who known? I could have been at Alvin Ailey School or Juilliard, or, you know, my range probably would have been different. I would have went into technical training and dancing, but it was just like not allowed. And then it was like I couldn't cheerlead. I wanted to do so many things as a child and activities, but I wasn't allowed. It wasn't until I was in high school and my mom left that church that I really started, I feel like, my life began. And I was like around 13 or 14.
Do you think that's why you do so much now? I mean, having a childhood restricted.
I do more now, but even as a child, I was like doing stuff in terms of like art. Like, I used to watch this show called The Imagination Station and Pappy Land, and I'd learn how to, I had my sketchbook. That's one thing my parents did support, was my arts. Like, they would, my mom really would buy me sketchbooks. My dad, he used to draw, so I get it from him, but he only did it as a hobby. Like, he would doodle Star Trek ships and characters, but he was really, really good. And so, you know, they never stopped me from doing that. And so, yeah, but I do think that the restraint of me not being able to do much as a child has influenced my life as an adult. And like I said, when I went to high school, it just was like things opened up and my mom let me do whatever. And I think part of her felt guilty that she had held her kids back from being able to express themselves the way they wanted to. So in high school, she gave us a lot more freedom to really just spread our wings.
Do you remember when you first discovered rap and hip hop?
Absolutely. I was a sophomore in high school, and there was a girl, her name was Kamisha, she's my homegirl, and we used to eat lunch together. And in high school, I just felt like I didn't know what clique I belonged to. I had lunch one day, my teacher set me up with a friend, and it was like each day of the week I had a different group I was trying to hang out with to feel more like a part of it. So I hanged out with the goth kids, I hanged out with the performance arts kids. One day I sat at the table and hung out with, I didn't even know it was the football team players table, I just sat there, and they were like, you sitting at our table, and but they were very welcoming. I just floated around a lot and met different people, but my one friend, she used to come to the lunchroom and she would rap, and then I would see her after school rap battling, freestyling against the boys, and she was winning. She would always win. And so I started writing. One day I came to the cafeteria and I had a piece of paper with my rhyme on it, my first 16 bars, and I rapped it to her, and she was like, "That's hot." I was like, no, it's not hot. She's like, that's hot. She always told me what I did was good, and it actually kept me going, even though I probably know I wasn't the best. So it's surprising that today I am still doing music and have gone where I've gone. And so at some point we used to rap. We used to call each other on the phone and just spit our hottest 16, like, years apart. And it's kind of like now we don't really talk. Like, I haven't heard from her in a while. But, yeah, it was in high school, and I wanted to rap because I like how, as a woman, you could rap. And if you were good, your voice commanded respect. And then commanded respect through your voice, people respected your body. They respected your personality. They respected who you were as a person. And so that's the type of respect she got, and that's what inspired me to want to rap and do music.
When you came to Baltimore for school, was that just like a free-for-all? I mean, what did you think when you first got here?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I never visited Baltimore. I didn't even know where it was on the map. It just so happened that Micah gave me a decent scholarship, and so my mom flew out with me first week of orientation, and I was definitely culture shock. I had never been anywhere past Georgia. So just coming up here and seeing all these things, like, I was so confused about life, and I almost left at one point. I was getting ready to transfer out because I wanted to go back home, but the deans were so encouraging at Micah that it's hard to leave somewhere when people don't want you to leave. So I did a quick turnaround. I decided to stay, and then I started to get active on campus. So I started doing a lot of the student activities. I became an orientation leader the next year. Then I was a RA. Like, so I got involved, which is what encouraged me to kind of stay in school, because once I did that, I felt a lot better and I felt more useful. I felt a purpose. So I was like, you know, I became a voice around campus. And so I think it foreshadowed my future. And so all those things I did as a child and in high school and then in college kind of shaped and molded me as a person I am today.
Did it ever feel challenging to carve out your own space in Baltimore and in the Baltimore music scene, not being from here?
Actually, it was at the beginning, because I really didn't start really making myself visible until 2009 in the city. Like, I started performing in 2009, and it's funny because my first live performance was for a nationwide syndicated network, which is the Stars Network, and I was in D.C. opening up for Wale before he became Wale, and it was on TV. It's still on YouTube, actually, but it was called Hip Hop Raw and Uncut, and I was like, couldn't believe that this is one of my first shows, and it was a packed house. And so once I did that, like, I've always been built to perform in front of a crowd. When I was in high school, I was in the band, so we had to perform at big homecoming parties and things like that, and games and football games. So it was always a big crowd. But when I started doing shows in Baltimore, I had no fear. It just was natural for me. One thing I always knew when I would get on stage, though, is to make sure I was prepared. I never got up there and played around. Like, if you're an artist and you're new to this, be prepared. Get up there and represent, you know, like, show these people that you're confident and show them that you're talented. And so that was always something that walked me in the door, not just through the venues, but also connecting with the producers here. I would walk into a studio, meet a producer, rap for him on site, and leave with 2 to 3 beats free of charge and come back and record free of charge. I never had to pay for recording fees. I just started paying for recording fees for my projects when I decided I wanted to elevate my sound. I started making more of an investment because people work, you know, people feel better when they're making money. So that was a whole nother lane in my development as an artist. But coming out in Baltimore wasn't hard for me to carve a lane at all, because it really wasn't a lot of artists doing what I was doing in 2009.
Your music blends a lot of different influences, and I feel like the Baltimore rap scene and club scene can be a little bit divided sometimes. Do you ever find it challenging to toe the line, or are you able to kind of seamlessly go back and forth and be accepted in all of the scenes?
I mean, it was seamless for me, because actually when I started out, I wasn't doing club music or dance music. I was doing more hip hop music. So I was connecting with a lot of the more urban acts in Baltimore, which is a whole different scene. And then I met Mighty Mark, who's one of my producers. And we started making music together like 2009 and into 2010 and so on. And through that, we started kind of catering my sound to this dance music world. And so it wasn't long before, you know, I got a phone call to work with Diplo, the producer Diplo. And I think after that, I just started getting more requests, you know, to do more features and work with different producers from different parts of the world. And so my voice started just to diversify. And then I met a few other producers that help me discover, oh, I can sing too, or oh, this is electronic music. Oh, so I just started to expand my sound, and I was always open to doing that. And I think you gotta be open to influence sometimes. Like, you can't always act like you know what you're doing, because you do yourself a disservice. It doesn't allow people to help you understand that you are talented in other lanes unless you open yourself up to the experience. So for me, it was a seamless transition, because I didn't just jump out there and start doing the music. I just started working on the sound first, making sure it sound good. Then we started releasing the music, and then I started doing the live performances for that music in those different scenes. So it was great, because it wasn't hard to transition, because it just felt natural.
Like you said, you used to kind of dabble more in, I guess, like a harder rap before you kind of went in the dance direction. Was there a time that you knew you had found your sound? You felt like, finally, like, I've got it. This is me. This is what I'm good at. Or has it all just, you know, kind of been a natural evolution along the way? What has that process been like for you?
I think when it comes to being an artist, there is that moment where you're looking for your sound. And then you tell yourself, I mean, I told myself that I don't think that I've been looking for my sound. I think people are looking for a sound for me. And so I think today I take ownership of all the sounds that I can do. And I realized, like, I've always had my sound. It was just a matter of people catching up to me and understanding what my sound was. So I think even more than ever today is me taking ownership of the many sides of my music, and that the great thing about it is whatever I decide to do or whatever lane I decide to float in, I can do it well. And that's kind of where I'm at with it. I take ownership of my sound and my versatility. And I think the only thing that is lacking, or that I would like to have more access to, is better production. And I work with great producers, and that's what we all strive for. We always strive to make the best sound, but due to like lack of spaces here in Baltimore to make music, it's not always easy to get that industry quality sound, you know. And also lack of resource, you know, you may not have a budget for a song that sounds like a top 40 record. So you really have to work with the people you're with, and you guys have to do your best to work with the budget you have to make something that sounds good, that the radio will like, or that fans will like. You know, like, I never, even though I'm independent, I don't think that just because you're independent, you should accept that as an excuse to not put out quality sounding music, like not focus on sound design. So one of the things that I'm doing in Baltimore is trying to be a face for Baltimore and sound design, and showing the world that quality music comes out of Baltimore that's playable.
How much do you think about critical or fan reception when you're making your music?
Well, how I feel about it is that's probably the most difficult part about being an artist. I don't even think it's so much of the fans. I think it's these writers out here who, you know, they have the golden key to make or break you publicly and press wise. And so I have consciously started to shift away from the blogs and stuff, because I see how much things get lost in translation. I feel like blogs post things that are not a good reflection of the music coming out of here, or they might post things that are just not accurate, but then they post your stuff, and here you got an artist who's been working for 7+ years, and you might take my project and not even take the time to research where this music is coming from and write something that's ridiculously the opposite of exactly what it is. And because of your following as a blog, you have all this influence. And so I'm consciously trying to figure out how to go around that, because I don't think that should be the only thing that people look at to validate an artist's music or their trajectory. And I'm trying to find other creative ways to give the public access to my music and just have the blogs as an extra incentive. But I think it's very difficult because they are so, like, people go to the blogs these days for information and content. And so I'm now pushing back on writers if I get a comment or, oh, we don't want this, because that's that pigeonhole effect. You may have some awesome records, but if it's not a dance record, they're like, we're not interested, we just want to post another shake your butt record, why are you making this difficult for us? Because that's not where I'm at right now. Where I'm at is I'm ready to show you my full range of sound. So if you want to get on board with that, this is good synergy. But if not, then I'll hit you up when I got another dance record that I need your support on. But right now I'm looking for that blog or that media platform that really wants to break the mold and really wants to do something different and highlight an artist for their full spectrum, not just what everybody's saying, you know? Because that's when it becomes a conversation. It's like, well, why go here? What about, why go there when you could have did this? And that's when you get the insight to what an artist is thinking, in my opinion, you know?
So you want them to come to you and come to your level, and you're not going to go to the fans level necessarily?
No. I want to be able, like I said, it's not the fans. The fans are always receptive. If they're a fan of yours, they're most likely going to be receptive, unless you totally flip the script on them. And then it's like, you're not going to necessarily lose all of them. They're just not going to always understand or get what you did. But what I'm saying is, I think that blogs need to start having more conversations with the artists versus just looking for content to post. Because what people need to realize is they need us before we need them. Without our content, without news, without these artists making, without the creatives, there's nothing for you to write about. So what I'm saying is, like, I feel like the blogs need to start having better conversations, especially with a lot of upcoming artists. Like, it's easy to have an interview with a Rihanna or a Nicki or, you know, artists that are out there and big. But a lot of these new artists who have these new sounds, who have these new ideas, I think people need to be more open to actually talking to them about that instead of just kind of biting on their viral record that's just big. Like, you could talk about that, but now let's talk about, what are you planning to do for the next 5 years, or when's your next release, or what are you thinking about? You know, I just think that it could be a little more personal and interactive active versus us as artists feeling like we just need this blog to do this write-up so we can get some likes on our social media or make it look like we are more reputable because we got posted on this blog. Like, I feel like it just needs to be more of an engaging conversation, you know? And that's what I'm doing when I hit up the blogs, and maybe that's stopping me from getting more write-ups, but I'm not really worried about that. I want it to be real, and I want to feel like you're actually listening to the music, and the feedback you're giving me is constructive criticism, not just you want to hear another shaky booty record, you know? Like, you just want to give me feedback, so, and we'll have a conversation. But I like constructive criticism. I don't think people are supposed to like everything you do, but if you don't like it, tell me why so I could think about that, you know?
It seems like shaping your own narrative does come up a lot in your music, and is the way you're putting out Queen of the Beat and releasing your music independently, I mean, is that your way of controlling the narrative to some extent?
For Queen of the Beat, you know, my first album, I would have loved to have been able to release it through a bigger network. Like, if a label came along and said, you know, we want to push this project, I think that would have been great. But I think with timing of everything, if that were to happen right now, like, if I were to, now that the music's done, if I were to send it to a label, probably wouldn't come out for another 2 to 3 months, just because labels want to be able to hit the marketing aspects. They want to brand you. They might not even want to put out the album yet. They might want to put out 2 singles first to get your fan base up more. But I think it was important for me to put this album out when I wanted to put it out. And honestly, it's a scary thing sometimes. Like, I'm not really scared of anything, but you put so much blood and sweat into your creativity just to put it out there, and people chop it up. And I don't think that's going to happen, but Queen of the Beat is not going to be that project people necessarily expect. And so that's been, like, all on my mind as well. But I do think it's important that as you're releasing music, you're thinking about the full spectrum of things. And I just didn't want anything holding me back, because it's a lot of logistics when you're dealing with a label. These are partnerships that you're having with other entities who are now investing money, percentages. It's all types of things involved when you're releasing a record with a label. They get say so and so much more than if you would have put it out by yourself. So I think for me, it was important not to have any walls for this particular project. But the next one, I'm definitely open to working with a label and trying to get it out there on a bigger platform.
What do you think is the state of Baltimore club music, and where do you think it's going?
I think Baltimore club music is well and alive. The word on the street is, through our neighboring cities who are also doing club music, is that Baltimore does not have sound design, and that we're still operating off of resampled and recompressed loops. So our music quality isn't playable in bigger arenas. And so we have producers here who are working on that. Mighty Mark, there's another producer named Mike Jr. who have a new group they're putting together called Hands Up. And their whole brand is to create sound design and Baltimore club music. And they're about to drop a few projects that's really going to catch on. And once they do that, I think there's going to be a lot of new energy around the genre. But what I can say is the music has never went anywhere. I just think that people need to be more proactive, as far as the local club community need to be proactive at working together with each other to make quality music. There's a lot of older producers who are still traveling and getting booked to do shows, and they could be helping out a lot of the new talent, you know, and creating sounds for the new talent and putting records out. People like to sit on music. Like, I know so many amazing producers right now who have folders and folders of club music, and they're just sitting on it, and I don't know why. And but I think the state of the music has never went anywhere. Like, I mean, we are global. It's just, I think where we're at is getting the respect and getting getting the actual world to understand what they're listening to, because club music is being put out all the time and it's playing around the world, but the world don't necessarily know it as Baltimore club music they're hearing, you know. So I think the radio, local radio stations can do better jobs at promoting new talent that's doing club music, new producers. And I think the community should support it even more. But people say Baltimore club music died. It never really died. It's just, I think the spirit of the people died, you know. But the music has always been circulating. How long have you been hearing Black Stars Tote It or Rah Rah Shake to the Ground? I can go to a club in New York and Berlin and hear club music. So I don't think the music's ever died. That's a big misconception. I think the spirit of the people died. And so where we're at right now is we're getting the spirit of the people back together, and we're also going against the notion that there's no sound design in Baltimore. And how we're going to do that is by putting out big anthems, big records, and making sure that the quality of the work is there so that it can be played not just in your local club, but at your local festival, your big arenas, and radio.
Do you still feel like an underdog being from Baltimore?
Oh, yeah. I just feel like an underdog, period, because, like I said, it depends on what you see as success as an artist. But I feel like an underdog because every day is a hustle still. I quit my 9-to-5 2 years ago, and I haven't worked a job since then. I've done this full time. And a big problem I see locally is that promoters do not want to pay the local talent. And I don't understand, because I stopped being local about a year ago. Once you leave the country, you're no longer local. Once you're doing shows in other states, you're no longer local. So when you get phone calls and you're asked to be an opening act and they don't have the budget to pay you, one of the artists who's going to actually bring out people locally, I think it's terrible, because that doesn't help the local artist community. And you know what that does? It forces us to move and go to other cities that will respect what we do and decide to help pay us so we can eat and come and show up and do our job. So I think that that needs to change. Like, we are doing things out here where we're performing, we're promoting, doing our own shows because we can't make money when we get booked locally. And I think people like the local venues need to support us more. You know, they need to, the local DJs need to support us more too and play our music, you know. And I just think that if we can work on that, you will see a shift overall. So I do feel like an underdog, in a sense that I've yet to feel like I can wake up and, you know, do whatever it is that I want to do. But I do wake up and do whatever it is I want to do, for the simple fact is I got to eat. So I'm just getting to the point where, you know, I'm seeing the success of what you can get when you do focus and work hard. But every day I work hard. Nothing is given to me. We spoke earlier about having a team, you know, if you're with a label and major support. Like, I had booking agents and they helped me get to point B, but now I'm looking for new booking agents, because you need that support and you need that help. If I want to get to a level where I'm traveling all over the world, I can't do that on my own. And I know I have the good music to take me there, but I need people who are experienced in those arenas to open those doors, you know? So you can do it on your own. It just takes a little longer, but that's why I say you should always be trying to build a team around you, because that's how it works.
What's your definition of success?
My definition of success is when you're able to sustain yourself off of your passion and your gifts, period. Like, I think every person should be working towards their passion in life. And if you don't know what that is, start exploring things. I told my friend to make a list of things you like to do. Now, I didn't say things that make you money. I just said, make a list of things you enjoy doing. If you make that list, you will find your purpose on it. Because most things that you like to do without money, or without, like, anything that you love to do can be turned into a passion. Some people say, I like to read. You could create a blog and start writing reviews on books that could grow. And the next thing you know, people are coming to you. You're paying. You might create a magazine. Like, one gift leads to another. So start with a list. If you're lost and you feel like, I don't know what it is I want to do. Like, I know what's convenient. I know what pays my bills. Even if you have a 9-to-5, you can take that money. And that's what I did. Start taking that money and put it into your passion, like what it is that you want to do. If you want to write a book and you're working at the coffee shop or at a restaurant, then when you go home, start writing that book. And before you know it, in 6 months or so, that book might be done, and enough, you've saved enough money to go get it printed and start researching how to get published. So now you got a whole book, then now you can market and pitch to all these bookstores, and now you're going to start making more money in one day than you would make in a week or two at your 9-to-5. And that's what I'm talking about. So I do think that success to me means when you're able to sustain yourself off of your passion.
TT, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Female Trouble. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at FML Trouble. If you liked what you heard, you can also subscribe and rate us on iTunes. Our theme music is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the artist. See you next week.